Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Throne of the Crescent Moon by Saladin Ahmed, performed by Phil Giganti. To my parents, Ismael Ahmed and the late Mary O'Leary, who introduced me to the fantastic world of books. To my wife, Haley Thompson, who supported me in countless ways as I wrote this one. And to my children, Malcolm and Naima, who make this broken world beautiful enough to keep living and writing in. This is for you. Part 1.
9 days. Beneficent God, I beg you, let this be the day I die.
The guardsman's spine and neck were warped and bent, but still he lived. He'd been locked in the red lacquered box for 9 days. He'd seen the day's light come and go through the lid crack.
9 days.
He held them close as a handful of dinars, counted them over and over.
9 days. 9 days. 9 days.
If he could remember this until he died, he could keep his soul whole for God's sheltering embrace. He had given up on remembering his name. The guardsman heard soft footsteps approach, and he began to cry. Every day for 9 days the gaunt, black-bearded man in the dirty white caftan had appeared. Every day he cut the guardsman, or burned him. But worst was when the guardsman was made to taste the other's pain. The gaunt man had flayed a young marsh girl, pinning the guardsman's eyes open so he had to see the girl's skin curl out under the knife. He'd burned a Bedouin boy alive and held back the guardsman's head so the choking smoke would enter his nostrils. The guardsman had been forced to watch the broken and burned bodies being ripped apart as the gaunt man's ghouls fed on heart flesh. He'd watched as the gaunt man's servant creature, that thing made of shadows and jackal skin, had sucked something shimmering from those freshly dead corpses, leaving them with their hearts torn out and their empty eyes glowing red. These things had almost shaken the guardsman's mind loose. Almost. But he would remember.
9 days. 9. Oh, merciful God, take me from this world!
The guardsman tried to steady himself. He'd never been a man to whine and wish for death. He'd taken beatings and blade wounds with gritted teeth. He was a strong man. Hadn't he guarded the Khalif himself once? What matter that his name was lost to him now?
Though I walk a wilderness of ghouls and wicked jinn, no fear can...
He couldn't remember the rest of the scripture. Even the heavenly chapters had slipped from him. The box opened in a painful blaze of light. The gaunt man in the filthy caftan appeared before him. Beside the gaunt man stood his servant. That thing. Part shadow. Part jackal. Part cruel man. That called itself Mawawa. The guardsman screamed. As always, the gaunt man said nothing. But the shadow thing's voice echoed in the guardsman's head.
Listen to Mawawa, who speaketh for his blessed friend. Thou art an honored guardsman, begat and born in the Crescent Moon Palace. Thou art sworn in the name of God to defend it. All of those beneath thee shall serve.
The words were a slow, probing drone in his skull. His mind swooned in a terror trance.
Yea, thy fear is sacred. Thy pain shall feed his blessed friend's spells. Thy beating heart shall feed his blessed friend's ghouls. Then, Mawawa, the man-jackal shall suck thy soul from thy body. Thou hast seen the screaming and begging and bleeding the others have done. Thou hast seen what will happen to thee soon.
From somewhere, a remembered scrap of a grandmother's voice came to the guardsman. Old tales of the power cruel men could cull from a captive's fear, or an innocent's gruesome slaying. Fear spells. Pain spells. He tried to calm himself, to deny the man in the dirty kaftan this power. Then he saw the knife. The guardsman had come to see the gaunt man's sacrifice knife as a living thing, its blade curve an angry eye. He soiled himself and smelled his own filth. He'd done so many times already in these 9 days. The gaunt man, still saying nothing, began making small cuts. The knife bit into the guardsman's chest and neck, and he screamed again, pulling against bonds he'd forgotten were there. As the gaunt man cut him, the shadow thing whispered in the guardsman's mind. It recalled to him all the people and places that he loved, restored whole scrolls of his memory. Then it told stories of what would soon come. Ghouls in the streets, all the guardsman's family and friends, all of Damsawat drowning in a river of blood. The guardsman knew these were not lies. He could feel the gaunt man feeding off of his fear, but he couldn't help himself. He felt the knife dig into his skin and heard whispered plans to take the throne of the Crescent Moon, and he forgot how many days he'd been there. Who was he? Where was he? There was nothing within him but fear, for himself and his city. Then there was nothing but darkness. Chapter 1. Damsawat, King of Cities, Jewel of Abyssin. 1,000,000 men pass through and pass in packed patchwork of avenues, alleys, and walls. Such bookshops and brothels, such schools and such stalls. I've wed all your streets, made your night air my wife. For he who tires of Damsawat tires of life. Dr. Abdullah Makhshlood, the last real ghoul hunter in the great city of Damsawat, sighed as he read the lines. His own case, it seemed, was the opposite. He often felt tired of life, but he was not quite done with Damsawat. After 60 and more years on God's great earth, Abdullah found that his beloved birth city was one of the few things he was not tired of. The poetry of Ismi Shihab was another. To be reading the familiar lines early in the morning in this newly crafted book made Abdullah feel younger, a welcome feeling. The smallish tome was bound with brown sheep leather, and Ismi Shihab's leaves of palm was etched into the cover with good golden acid. It was a very expensive book, but Hafi, the bookbinder, had given it to Abdullah free of charge. It had been 2 years since Abdullah saved the man's wife from a cruel Magus's water ghouls, but Hafi was still effusively thankful. Abdullah closed the book gently and set it aside. He sat outside of Yeye's, his favorite tea house in the world, alone at a long stone table. His dreams last night had been grisly and vivid. Blood rivers, burning corpses, horrible voices. But the edge of their details had dulled upon waking. Sitting in his favorite place, face over a bowl of cardamom tea, reading Ismi Shihab, Abdullah almost managed to forget his nightmares entirely. The table was hard against Damsawat's great mainway, the broadest and busiest thoroughfare in all the Crescent Moon kingdoms. Even at this early hour, people half crowded the mainway. A few of them glanced at Abdullah's impossibly white kaftan as they passed, but most took no notice of him. Nor did he pay them much mind. He was focused on something more important. Tea. Abdullah leaned his face farther over the small bowl and inhaled deeply, needing its aromatic cure for the fatigue of life. The spicy, sweet cardamom steam enveloped him, moistening his face and his beard, and for the first time that groggy morning he felt truly alive. When he was outside of Damsawat, stalking bone ghouls through cobwebbed catacombs, or sand ghouls across dusty plains, he often had to settle for chewing sweet tea root. Such campfireless times were hard. But as a ghoul hunter, Abdullah was used to working within limits. When one faces two ghouls, waste no time wishing for fewer, was one of the adages of his antiquated order. But here at home, in civilized Damsawat, he felt he was not really a part of the world until he'd had his cardamom tea. He raised the bowl to his lips and sipped, relishing the piquant sweetness. He heard Yeye's shuffling approach, smelled the pastries his friend was bringing. This, Adula thought, was life as beneficent God intended it. Yeye set his own tea bowl and a plate of pastries on the stone table with two loud clinks, then slid his wiry frame onto the bench beside Adula. Adula had long marveled that the cross-eyed, limping tea-house owner could whisk and clatter bowls and platters about with such efficiency and so few shatterings. A matter of practice, he supposed. Adula knew better than most that habit could train a man to do anything. Yeye smiled broadly, revealing the few teeth left to him. He gestured at the sweets.
Almond nests, the first of the day before I've even opened my doors, and God save us from fat friends who wake too early.
Adula waved a hand dismissively.
When men reach our age, my friend, we should wake before the sun. Sleep is too close to death for us.
Yeye grunted.
So says the master of the half-day nap. And why this dire talk again, huh? You've been even gloomier than usual since your last adventure.
Adula plucked up an almond nest and bit it in half. He chewed loudly and swallowed, staring into his tea bowl while Yeye waited for his reply. Finally Adula spoke, though he did not look up.
Gloomy. I have cause to be. Adventure, you say? A fortnight ago I was face to face with a living bronze statue that was trying to kill me with an axe. An axe, Yeye!
He shook his head at his own wavering tea reflection.
70 years old, and still I'm getting involved in such madness. Why?
He asked, looking up. Yeye shrugged.
Because God the All-Knowing made it so. You've faced such threats and worse before, my friend. You may look like the son of a bear who screwed the buzzard, but you're the only real ghoul hunter left in this whole damned by God city, O great and virtuous doctor.
Yeye was baiting him by using the pompous honorifics ascribed to a physician. The ghoul hunters had shared the title of doctor, but little else with the great and virtuous menders of the body. No leech-wielding charlatan of a physician could stop the fanged horrors that Adula had battled.
How would you know what I look like, Sixteeth? You whose crossed eyes can see nothing but the bridge of your own nose.
Despite Adula's dark thoughts, trading the familiar insults with Yeye felt comfortable, like a pair of old, well-made sandals. He brushed almond crumbs from his fingers onto his spotless kaftan. Magically, the crumbs and honey spots slid from his blessedly unstainable garment to the ground.
You are right, though, he continued. I have faced worse. But this...
Adula slurped his tea. The battle against the bronze man had unnerved him. The fact that he had needed his assistant Rashid's sword arm to save him was proof that he was getting old. Even more disturbing was the fact that he'd been daydreaming of death during the fight. He was tired, and when one was hunting monsters, tired was a step away from dead.
The boy saved my fat ass. I'd be dead if not for him.
It wasn't easy to admit.
Your young assistant? No shame in that. He's a dervish of the order. That's why you took him in, right? For his forked sword, cleaving the right from the wrong and all that.
It's happened too many times of late.
Adula said,
I ought to be retired, like Daoud and his wife.
He sipped and then was quiet for a long moment.
I froze, Yeye. Before the boy came to my rescue, I froze. And do you know what I was thinking? I was thinking that I would never get to do this again.
sit at this table with my face over a bowl of good cardamom tea. Yehye bowed his head, and Abdullah thought his friend's eyes might be moist.
You would have been missed. But the point is that you did make it back here, praise be to God.
Aye.
And why, 16th, don't you say to me, now stay home, you old fart? That is what a real friend would say to me. There are things you can do, oh buzzard-beaked bear, that others can't, and people need your help. God has called you to this life. What can I say that will change that?
Yeye's mouth tightened and his brows drew down.
Besides, who says home is safe? That madman, the Falcon Prince, is going to burn this city down around our ears any day now, mark my words!
They had covered this subject before. Yehye had little use for the treasonous theatrics of the mysterious master thief who called himself the Falcon Prince. Abdullah agreed that the prince was likely mad, but he still found himself approving of the would-be usurper. The man had stolen a great deal from the coffers of the caliph and rich merchants, and much of that money found its way into the hands of Damsawa'at's poorest, sometimes hand-delivered by the Falcon Prince himself. Yehye sipped his tea and went on.
He killed another of the caliph's headsmen last week, you know. That's two now.
He shook his head.
Two agents of the caliph's justice murdered.
Abdullah snorted.
Caliph's justice! Now there are two words that refuse to share a tent. That piece of shit isn't half as smart a ruler as his father was, but he's twice as cruel. Is it justice to let half the city starve while that greedy son of a whore sits on his brocaded cushions eating peeled grapes? Is it justice to—
Yehye rolled his crossed eyes, a grotesque sight.
No speeches, please. No wonder you like the villain. You've both got big mouths. But I tell you, my friend, I am serious. This city can't hold a man like that, and one like the new caliph at the same time. We are heading for battle in the streets. Another civil war!
Abdullah scowled.
May it please God to forbid it.
Yehye stood up, stretched, and clapped Abdullah on the back.
Aye. May all merciful God put old men like us quietly in our graves before this storm hits.
The cross-eyed man did not look particularly hopeful of this. He squeezed Adula's shoulder.
Well, I'll let you get back to your book, O Kamel of the Golden Glasses.
Abdullah groaned. Back when he'd been a street-brawling youth on Dead Donkey Lane, he himself had used the folktale hero's name to tease boys who read. He'd learned better in the decades since. He placed a hand protectively over his book.
You should not condemn poetry, my friend. There's wisdom in these lines about life, death, one's own fate.
No doubt.
Yehye aped the act of reading a non-existent book in the air before him, running a finger over the imaginary words and speaking in a grumble that was an imitation of Abdullah's own.
Oh, how hard it is to be so fat. Oh, how hard it is to have so large a nose. Oh, beneficent God, why do the children run a-screaming when I come a-walking?
Before Abdullah could come up with a rejoinder on the fear Yehye's own crossed eyes inspired in children, the tea-house owner limped off, chuckling obscenities to himself. His friend was right about one thing. Abdullah was, praise God, alive and back home. Back in the jewel of Abesin, the city with the best tea in the world. Alone again at the long stone table, he sat and sipped and watched early morning Damsawa'at come to life and roll by. A thick-necked cobbler walked past, two long poles strung with shoes over his shoulder. A woman from Rugelbe strode by, a bouquet in her hands, and the long trail of her veil flapping behind. A lanky young man with a large book in his arms and patches in his caftan moved idly eastward. As he stared out onto the street, Adula's nightmare suddenly reasserted itself with such force that he could not move or speak. He was walking, wading through Damsawa'at's streets, waist high in a river of blood. His caftan was soiled with gore and filth. Everything was tinted red, the color of the traitorous angel. An unseen voice, like a jackal howling human words, clawed at his mind. And all about him, the people of Dom Soa'at lay dead and disemboweled. Name of God! He forced himself to breathe. He watched the men and women on the mainway, very much alive and going about their business. There were no rivers of blood, no jackal howls. His kaftan was clean. Adula took another deep breath.
Just a dream. The world of sleep invading my days, he told himself. I need a nap.
He took a second-to-last slurp of tea, savoring all of the subtle spices that Ye Ye layered beneath the cardamom. He shook off his grim thoughts as best he could and stretched his legs for the long walk home. He was still stretching when he saw his assistant, Rasid, emerge from the alley on the teahouse's left. Rasid strode toward him, dressed as always in the impeccable blue silk habit of the Order of Dervishes. The holy warrior pulled a large parcel behind him, something wrapped in gray rags. No, not something. Someone. A long-haired little boy of perhaps 8 years, with blood on his clothes.
Oh, please no.
Adula's stomach clenched up.
Merciful God, help me, what now?
Adula reached deep and somehow found the strength to set down his tea bowl and rise to his feet. Chapter 2 Adula watched Rasid weave between the teahouse tables, pulling the child gently along. They came to a halt before him, their backs to the mainway's throng of people. Rasid bowed his blue turbaned head. Looking more closely, Adula did not think the frightened-looking, long-haired child was wounded. The blood on his clothing seemed to be someone else's.
God's peace, doctor,
said Rasid.
This is Faisal. He needs our help.
The dervish's hand rested on the hilt of the curved, fork-tipped sword at his hip. He stood 5 lithe feet, not much bigger than the child beside him. His fine-boned yellow features were delicate and highlighted by tilted eyes. But Adula knew better than anyone that Rasid's slender frame and clean-shaven face hid a zealous killer's skill.
God's peace, boy, and to you, Faisal. What is the problem?
He asked the dervish. Rasid's expression was grim.
The boy's parents have been murdered.
He darted his dark eyes at Faisal, but made no attempt to soften his tone.
With apologies, doctor, my knowledge is insufficient, but from Faisal's description, I believe ghouls attacked the boy's family. Also,
2 porters passed, each shouting at the other to go screw a pickle barrel, and the soft-spoken dervish's words were drowned out.
What was that?
Adula asked.
I said that I was sent here by... Faisal is...
He hesitated.
What? What is it?
Adula asked.
Faisal's aunt is known to you, doctor. It was she who brought him to your townhouse.
Adula looked down at Faisal, but the child said nothing.
Stop this mysterious monkey shit, you stuttering dervish. Who is the child's aunt?
Rasid's bird-like mouth tightened in distaste.
Mistress Miri El Musa is the boy's aunt.
God damn me.
Her courier brought the boy and this note, doctor.
He drew a rolled piece of rough paper from his blue silk tunic and handed it over. Dooley, you know how things stand between us. I wouldn't have bothered you if the need weren't great. But my niece is dead, Dooley. Murdered. Her and her fool marshman husband. To hear Faisal speak, it was neither a man nor an animal that killed them. That means you will know more than anyone in this city about what to do. I need your help. Faisal here will tell you all that happened. Send him back to my house when you have learned what you must from him. God's peace be with you. Miri.
God's peace be with you.
Adula read the words aloud, a bit incredulous. Such a passionless, formulaic closing from his old heart's flame. Mistress Miri El Musa, seller of silks and sweets, known to a select few as Miri of the Hundred Ears. Adula pictured her, middle-aged and still able to fill him with more lust than a girl of half her years, sitting in her brothel office among 100 scraps of paper and a half-dozen letter pigeons. It was true that their last meeting had not been a happy one, but was she really so fed up with him that even in such a dire situation she had sent a note instead of coming herself? The rosewater-scented memory of her threatened to overwhelm him, but he shoved it to the side. He needed analysis now, not heartsick nostalgia. The dried blood on Faisal's rough-spun shirt must have been from one of his parents. Miri had not even wasted time changing the child's clothes before sending him over.
So you are Miri's grand-nephew. I remember her speaking of a niece who lived out near the marsh docks.
Yes, doctor.
The boy's tone was hard and flat, the voice of one who has refused to let his mind absorb what his eyes have seen.
And why, Faisal, have you come all the way to the city for help? There's a large watchman's barracks at the marsh docks. The Caliph has treasure houses there, after all. Did you not tell the watchman what happened?
The child's features twisted with bitterness that belied his, perhaps, 10 years.
I tried, but the watchmen don't listen to marsh boys. They don't care what happens outside the treasure house walls, long as the Caliph's gold and gem thread are safe. My mama told me that my auntie Miri in the city had a friend who was a real ghoul hunter, like in the stories. So I come to Damsawat.
Adula smiled sadly.
Very little in life is like the stories, Faisal.
But my mama and my da.
Faisal's tough marsh boy mask slipped and tears fell.
Adula was not at his ease with children.
He stroked the boy's long black hair, hoping this was the right thing to do.
I know, little one, I know. But I need you to be strong right now, Faisal. I need you to tell me exactly what happened.
Adula sat back down, seating the child opposite him. Rasheed remained standing, hand on hilt, his tilted eyes watching the crowds that walked past the tea house. Faisal told his story. Adula sorted through babbling, sobs, and the exaggerations of fear, trying to isolate useful information. There was little to isolate. Faisal lived with his parents in the marshes a day's ride from the city. While out spearfishing with another family, they had been set upon by hissing, gray-skinned monsters, man-shaped, but not human. Bone ghouls, unless Adula missed his guess. Strong as half a dozen men and as hard to kill, with gruesome claws besides. Faisal had fled, but not before he'd seen the ghouls start to eat the heart muscle of his still-living parents. The blood on his shirt was his father's. Faisal was the only one who'd escaped. Adula had seen grisly things in his work, but sometimes it was worse seeing the effect such things had on others.
I ran away and left them. Mama said run, and I did. It's my fault they're dead.
He began bawling again.
My fault!
Adula wrapped an arm awkwardly around the boy. He felt like a great ape coddling a new hatched chick.
It is not your fault, Faisal. A man made those ghouls. Almighty God willing, we will find this man and keep his creatures from hurting others. Now I need you to tell me just once more what happened. Everything, every detail you can remember.
Adula extracted another telling of the incident. He didn't like doing it, making the child relive this horror twice and thrice over. But he had to if he was going to do his job. Frightened people often remembered things falsely, even when they meant to be honest. He listened for new details and inconsistencies, not because he distrusted the boy, but because people never remembered things exactly the same way twice. Still, Adula found Faisal a better source of information than most grown men who'd laid eyes on a ghoul. He was a marshman, after all, and they were tough and observant folk. No people, not even the Bedouin of the desert, lived closer to starvation. Adula could remember Miri's disgust a dozen years ago when she'd learned that her niece was marrying a marshman.
What is there for her out there?
She'd asked Adula over a game of backgam. He had been unable to answer. He was as thoroughly a city creature as she was. But there was no denying that where life itself depended on spearing quick fish and raising fragile golden rice, attentiveness flourished. Faisal's retellings informed Adula that three creatures had attacked, and that no man had been visible at the time. Adula turned to Rashid.
Three of the things commanded outside of the line of sight. This is not the usual half-dinar magus, heady with the power of his first ghoul raising. Troubling.
The heavenly chapters decreed that ghoul makers were damned to the lake of flame. The chapters spoke of an ancient, corrupted age when wicked men commanded whole legions of the things from miles away. But those times were past. In all his years of ghoul hunting, Adula had never seen a man make more than two of the monsters at a time, and this always from a few hundred yards away at most.
Troubling, he said again.
He instructed Rashid to cut a small scrap from the boy's scarlet-stained shirt. Other than the name of its maker, the blood of a ghoul's victim was the best component for a tracking spell. The creatures themselves would likely prove easy enough to find, but he would need to head closer to the scene of the slaying and get away from the city's teeming, confusing life energies to cast an effective tracking spell. Adula only prayed that he would be able to find the creatures before they fed again. As the silent prayer echoed in his mind, he felt a weary determination rising in his heart. There was more bloody work to be done.
Oh God, why must it be me every time?
Adula had paid his fare for the festival of this world, as the poets say, many times over. It was some younger man's turn to do this. But there was no younger man that could do it without him, Adula knew. He had fought beside many men, but had never had the wherewithal to train another in the ways of his near-dead order, had never been able to bring himself to set another on his own thankless road. 2 years ago he'd reluctantly agreed to take Rashid as an assistant, but while the boy's martial powers were unmatched, he had no talent for invocations. He was an excellent apprentice in the ends of ghoul hunting, but his means to those ends were his own, and they were different than Adula's. In ages past, the makers and the hunters of ghouls alike were more plentiful. Old Dr. Bujali, Adula's own mentor, had explained it early in Adula's apprenticeship.
It's an almost dead art I'm teaching you here, young one, he had said. Once the ghoul makers ran rampant over God's great earth, and more of our order were needed. These days, well, few men use ghouls to prey on one another. The Caliph has his soldiers, and his court magi to keep what he calls order. And if a few fiendish men still follow the traitorous angel's ways and gain their power through the death and dismembering of poor people, well, that's of little concern to those who rule from the palace of the Crescent Moon. Even in other lands, the ghoul hunters are not what we once were. The Sioux Pashas have their own mercenaries, and their glorious guardians. The High Sultan of Rugalbe controls those few who still know our ways. They are part of his heavenly army, whether they wish it or not. Our work is not like the heroism of the old stories. No vast armies of abomination stand before us. These days we save a fishmonger here, a porter's wife there. But it is still God's work. Never forget that.
But in the many years since Dr. Bujali had first said these words to Adula, it sometimes seemed that the scale arm was swinging back in the old direction. Adula and his friends had dispatched enough fiendish creatures over the decades to make him suspect that the old threats were starting to regain a foothold on God's great earth. Yet he had not deigned to raise scores of new ghoul hunters. Instead, for reasons known only to he who holds all answers, God had seen fit to pile trouble after trouble onto the stooped shoulders of a few old folks. One day very soon, Adula feared his spine would snap under the strain. Why was Adula made to bear so big a burden alone? When would others learn to defend themselves from the servants of the traitorous angel? What would happen after he was gone? Adula had asked Almighty God these questions 10,000 times in his life, But he who holds all answers had never deigned to respond. It seemed that Ardula's gifts were always just enough to keep the creatures he faced in check. But he wondered again why God had made his life in this world such a tiring, lonely chore. Still as tired of life as he sometimes felt, and as foolish as he found most men to be, he could never quite manage to leave people to their cruelest fate. He drew in a resigned breath, let it out again, and stood. His tea bowl was empty, digging into the seemingly endless folds of his moonlight white caftan. Ardula drew forth a copper fells and slapped it onto the table. As if he'd been summoned by the sound, Yeye appeared. He exchanged God's pieces with Rasid, then cast a cross-eyed frown at Faisal's bloody clothes. But all he said as he and Ardula embraced and kissed on both cheeks in the familiar parting gesture was,
"Stay safe, Buzzard Beak."
"I will try, Sixteeth," Ardula replied.
He turned to Rasid and Faisal. "Come on, you two." Rasid stepped silently out from where he leaned against the teahouse wall. It was like watching a shadow come to life and peel itself from the sandstone. They joined the flow of the mainway, Ardula and the dervish keeping the child between them. At the corner, Ardula waved over Camelback, a porter he'd known for years. Camelback was nearly a foot shorter than Ardula, but had shoulders enough for two men. The men exchanged God's pieces and cheek kisses. Ardula pressed a coin into the porter's palm.
"Take Faisal here to Mistress Miri Elmusa's place in the singer's quarter."
He had to speak loudly to be heard over a braying donkey half a block ahead. The child panicked all over again.
But, don't you need me to come with you, Doctor? To show you the way?"
"No, child," Ardula said, leaning down. "I will use my magic to track the ghouls. You would slow us down, and besides, I will not put you in danger."
"I'm not afraid."
Looking into his eyes, Ardula believed him. If Faisal came across the ghouls again, he would not run a second time. And that could only mean a little boy's death. Ardula had seen such before. He had no desire to bear witness to it again.
"I promise you, Faisal, we will avenge your family. But your mother gave everything so that you could live. Do not throw that away so quickly. You will make her happiest by being a good boy and living a long life."
Ardula paused, letting the words sink in. The child nodded, though he was clearly unconvinced. He went with Camelback, and they were soon swallowed by the crowd. Ardula turned to Rasid, only to find the dervish glaring at him.
"What? Why are you scowling so, boy?"
Somewhere behind them on the street, someone dropped something that broke loudly and gave off a vinegared scent. Rasid glanced back, glanced at Ardula, and sniffed.
"You just sent a child, barely 10, back to a house of ill repute."
He pursed his thin lips in disapproval. The little holy man could be so thick sometimes.
"I sent him to his auntie's house, to one of the few places in the city where a penniless little orphan would be well treated, even were he not related to the proprietress. Miri and her girls always have need of an errand boy or two."
"O believer, if a man asks you to choose between virtue and your brother, choose virtue."
Rasid quoted from the heavenly chapters.
"There are charitable orders where the boy would be better served. To grow up among such degenerate women is..."
Ardula felt his fire rise at the boy's words. The last time he'd seen her, almost 2 years ago now, Miri Al-Musa had made it clear that she wanted nothing more to do with him. Nonetheless, he'd be damned if he'd stand for her being insulted. He made his voice dangerous.
"About whom exactly are you speaking, boy?"
The dervish clearly thought better of elaborating. His blue turban bobbed in a bow.
"My apologies, Doctor. I meant only that a virtuous upbringing in one of the city's orphan halls, where the boy could learn a trade, would..."
"Would doom the boy to 6 nights a week of under-the-sheets upbringing by some drunken godly servant of children. They'd leave him alone on prayers day." "Huh. He'd learn a trade, all right."
"Doctor, I can't believe..."
Rasid's words were cut off when a big bull of a woman shouldered her way between the pair, cursing them for standing idle in the street. Abdullah started walking again, and the dervish followed.
"Please, boy," Abdullah said, "spare me your solemn protestations regarding that which you know nothing of."
He'd be more likely to become a whore in one of those terror houses than he would if he'd been living at Miri's from the day of his birth. In my orphan days, I dodged such places for the dungeons they were. Nothing's changed.
Now!
Abdullah half shouted, clapping his hands together in an effort to disperse the argument.
I need to go home and gather some spell supplies, then we head out of the city. Let's get moving. If we linger too long, I'll end up thinking better of this.
They quickened their pace as much as the press of people would allow. The sun shone clearly as they stepped out of the street and its building shadows and crossed the open space of Angel Square. Abdullah did not stop and marvel yet again at the almost living expressions on the ancient statuary faces of the ministering angels. He did, however, push brusquely through a knot of oddly dressed, gawking city visitors who stood staring crane-necked at the lifelike marble work.
Bumpkins,
Abdullah griped to himself, but he didn't really blame them. Even when civil war had racked the city 200 years earlier, Angel's Square had been a sanctuary of sorts. All sides had agreed to shed no blood on its stones. Though crowded cheek to jowl with refuge seekers, one could taste the peace of the place in the air, or so the historians and passed-down stories said. Today, aside from the pack of sightseers, the square was largely quiet. If there wasn't such grim work before him, Abdullah thought he might have felt some of the old peace. Instead, his thoughts were on tracking spells and a child's bloodied clothing. He and Rasid left Angel Square behind for grimy Gruel Lane. On the Caliph's maps, the narrow, dirty street that led from the square to Abdullah's neighborhood bore the name of some long-dead ruler. But for centuries, Dom Sawaites had called it Gruel Lane for its poverty and its inhospitable inns. Avoiding the occasional puddle of piss, Abdullah made it to the corner that marked the border of his rough neighborhood, the ironically named Scholar's Quarter. Pious old Munish, with his wisps of white hair and his roasted nut stall, stood on the corner agitating fire-heated trays of sugared almonds and salted pistachios. The aroma made Abdullah's mouth water. He stopped to buy a handful of roasted pistachios.
Doctor!
Rasid had been silent for much of their walk home, and Abdullah had almost forgotten he was there. The dervish was clearly scandalized by the delay. Abdullah wished he were young enough to believe that zeal and an urge to combat monsters were enough to fill one's stomach. But the years had taught him otherwise, and he had a long day ahead of him.
I've had only half a breakfast, boy. I need sustenance to think clearly, and a handful of moments here will matter little enough. The heavenly chapters say a starving man builds no palaces.
They also say for the starving man prayer is better than food.
Abdullah gave up. He grunted to Rasid, thanked Munesh, and walked on, cracking shells and munching noisily. His assistant was a true dervish of the order, truer than most of the hypocritical peacocks who wore the blue silks. He had spent years hardening his diminutive body, his only purpose to be a fitter and fitter weapon of God. To Abdullah's mind, it was an unhealthy approach to life for a boy of 7 and 10. True, God had granted Rasid more than human powers. Armed with the forked sword of his order, he was nearly invincible. Even without the sword, the boy could take on half a dozen men at once. Abdullah had seen him do it. But the fact that he had never so much as kissed a girl lessened Abdullah's respect for him considerably. Still, it was Rasid's pious discipline that made him such a good battle companion. A man's character was most clearly displayed in the uses he put his gifts to. In his 40 years as a ghoul hunter, Abdullah had seen a man jump 20 feet into the air, and had watched a girl turn water into fire. He had seen a warrior split himself into 2 warriors, then 4. He had watched as an old lady made trees walk. What he had seen people do with such powers varied as much or as little as the people themselves. Their motivations covered the same range of reasons all men and women did things. Occasionally they helped other people and made sacrifices. More often they acted selfishly and did wrong to their fellow children of God. Rashid, for his part, always went the first route. A neighbor's child hollered Abdullah's name and waved in greeting from across the packed dirt street. Clearing his mind of extraneous thoughts and slurping the last bits of salt and pistachio from his fingers, Abdullah waved back and stepped onto his own block. He passed the small sandstone shop that belonged to his friends and ex-traveling companions, Dawood and Litas, a Sioux couple who had lived in the city for decades. Apparently they were not home. The shop's cedar shutters were drawn tight. Too bad. Abdullah would never have asked his retired friends to accompany him on the school hunt. But Litas had kept up with her alchemy, and it would have been nice to borrow one of her remarkable freezing solutions or explosive preparations to aid in his work. But it was Eid's day, so Abdullah guessed that the couple would be spending the day and perhaps the night with friends at the Western Market, where traders from the Sioux Republic swept in once a month with ivory, gold, and the yam candies that Litas always had on hand to remind herself of home. Finally, he and Rashid reached the pale stone townhouse that had been Adula's thin slice of Damsoat for 20-odd years. Abdullah opened the white-painted wood door of the townhouse and stepped through the gently arched doorway, the dervish following. It was no palace, but it was much better than the hovels that were his origin and likely inheritance as an orphan on Dead Donkey Lane. That he'd been able to buy the building at all had been due to the vagaries of his calling, which for once had worked to his advantage. Many years ago, he had, with Dawood and Litas, fought a golden snake 40 feet long, with huge rubies for eyes, an ancient monster created in the days of the pharaohs of Khem, and awakened by a greedy man's digging. Just looking at the glittering serpent caused magical fear in even a stout heart, and it had already slain a squadron of the old caliph's watchmen. But Abdullah and his friends had ambushed the creature and drained its animating magic. The serpent had collapsed as they'd watched, crumbling into huge piles of gold dust. Near 30 years later, Abdullah could still smilingly recall the sound of those fist-sized rubies falling to the ground. "I am now a rich man," he remembered thinking, as he and his friends had gleefully scooped gold dust into their pouches and sacks, doing little dances of celebration all the while. It had been a treasure to rival those of Damsoat's great merchants. And though, over the past 20-odd years, his calling had forced him to undertake several expensive journeys to distant places, he still had a respectable sum. He had no wife or children to keep, after all. His expenses had increased 2 years ago when Rashid, who had aided Abdullah admirably in a ghoul hunt, had asked to stay on as an assistant. But even that had not cost him much, as the boy ate such simple fare. Abdullah set to gathering his things. The marshes were less than a day's ride west by mule, so they'd need little in the way of traveling supplies. But there were preparations to be made for any ghoul hunt. He slung a large, worn satchel of brown calfskin over his shoulder and moved about the townhouse's book and box-cluttered rooms. As he went, he stuffed the bag with things collected from shelves, tabletops, and undusted corners. A punk of aloe wood, a box of scripture-engraved needles, a vial of dried mint leaves, pouches and packets, scraps of paper and bright little bottles wrapped in cloth. In a quarter hour's time he was ready to go, and Rashid was already standing by the door, cleaning his sword. The dervish's own possessions were few. The sword, his blue silks, his turban made from a length of strong silk that could double for climbing or binding. He toted a square pack on his back that held their foodstuffs, a half-tent, and a small cookpot. The boy ran his gaze up and down his sword's blade and slid it carefully into its ornate sheath of blue leather and lapis lazuli. Abdullah had watched him clean the blade just yesterday, and he doubted that the boy's sword had grown dirty since then. But he had come to understand that this ritual of Rashid's was about more than maintaining a cherished weapon. It was about focus. About reminding himself each and every day what truly mattered to him. Taking a last, long look around the bookshelves and bureaus of his townhouse, Abdullah himself felt something similar. Chapter 3 Men and women packed the stone mainway and the side streets, inching along and shouting in competition for the few sedan chairs and mule rides available. From what Adula could see, those on foot were actually moving faster, which meant that they would be walking to the stables at the edge of the city. Wonderful. He ought to have been born a Bedouin tribesman for all the walking he had done in his life. But on they walked, moving westward for half an hour.
So here we are again.
He grunted at Rasid, tired of the silence between them.
Leaving behind safety and comfort to kill monsters. Maybe to be killed. Almighty God knows I don't have much more of this left in me. You'll soon have to do this without a mentor, you know.
You don't really mean that, Doctor.
The boy crinkled his fine-featured face in distaste as they passed a refuse cart, broken down in the middle of the street and stinking in the morning sun.
I don't mean it. Need I remind you of our last excursion? I was nearly beheaded, boy. This is how an old man should be living.
We saved lives, Doctor. Children's lives.
Adula managed to half-smile at the dervish.
I wish the knowledge of that still kept my feet from aching, the way it did when I was your age, he thought. I wish it could keep me from freezing up and accepting death.
But what he said was,
yes, I suppose we did.
They kept walking, making their way past the gaudy storefronts that lined the Lane of Monkeys. Adula watched an ancient husband and wife sitting cross-legged on a long reed mat in front of a tea house ahead of them. They were all dirty gray hair and wrinkled brown skin, playing a fierce game of backgammon. The man moved his token across the board's painted sword tips, and with a loud clack and a victorious smile, landed on the first sword. The old woman was about to lose. She scowled and spat, the glob nearly hitting Rasid as he and Adula walked by. Just after they passed the old couple, Adula heard the rattle of triangle dice in the Beckham cup, the clatter as they hit the board, and a series of shouts. The old woman cackled and began a taunting, incomprehensible victory song as her husband cursed in disbelief. She'd rolled an 8.
That should be Miri and me,
Adula couldn't help thinking. He should have married Miri a long time ago. He should have left the lunatic life of a ghoul hunter. Instead, year after year, he had foolishly decided that fighting fanged things and stopping the spells of wicked men was more important than happiness. Instead of a blissful marriage, he had monstrosities on his mind and a pile of should-haves pressing down upon his soul. He and Rasid finally neared the western gate, which would take them out of the city. As they crossed a small alleyway, a doe-eyed girl of an age with Rasid smiled a none-too-shy smile at the dervish. Rasid made a choking noise and kept his eyes on the ground until the girl was a block away. Though he knew it was a lost cause, Adula couldn't help himself.
What is wrong with you, boy? Did you not see the way that little flower looked at you? You could have at least smiled back.
Doctor, please.
The boy paused.
This attack. You spoke of the extraordinary powers of this ghoul pax master. Do you think one of the 1,001, rather than a man, made these ghouls?
So much focus on duty. So much neglect of what really matters. He doesn't know the painful end of this road.
Adula abandoned his avuncular attempt to get Rasid to act like a living, breathing young man. The dervish would rather think about monsters than smile at a girl.
Very well.
But he sounded too eager about the possibility of fighting a djinn.
If he'd ever actually faced one of the 1,001 in battle, he'd feel differently. It wasn't a djinn, boy. When one of the Fireborn strikes, no one escapes, least of all a child.
The dervish nodded thoughtfully. Whatever else Adula found irritating about Rasid, he was at least deferential to Adula's experience.
I wonder,
Adula continued as they rounded a corner, but the words twisted into a shouted curse as he saw the massive crowd that lay before them.
Ah, God's balls, the horrible halt!
Adula pronounced the Damsawati term for the complete standstill of traffic with a familiar disgust. Before them, A wall of people seemed to rise up as the blocks-long tangle of carts, camels, and fools slowly pinched its way through the wide western gate. Abdullah collided with an unwashed little man who had been walking in front of him. He barely acknowledged the man's loud admonition to watch where he put his big feet.
"Some sort of gate inspection?"
Rasid asked. Abdullah snorted.
"Gate inspection. Tariff checks, watchman's business. It's all the same monkey shit. And there's more of it every day."
At the rate the line was moving, it would be another hour before they were through. A ghoul pack was loose, which meant lives were at stake. But Dom Sawa'at's 100 headaches hurried for no man. One did not walk through the gates of Dom Sawa'at the way one walked through a townhouse door. There was first the gray stone inner wall, then one passed through Inspector's Square, and then through the great main wall, 100 feet thick. Then one crossed a house-lined lane past the last guard wall before taking the bridge of yellow roses over a ditch. The process had never been a quick one, and due to the new caliph's poor city management, it took longer than ever. The duo cut through the throng as best they could without being truly rude. Abdullah did not want to start a fight, and fights were not uncommon in situations like these. Another quarter hour, and he and Rasid managed to get near the wide gate at the main wall. There the road rose slightly, and Abdullah saw that this was more than a simple traffic tangle. An execution. The great gray paving stones of Inspector's Square had been cleared of carts. At its center lay a worn leather mat. A boy of no more than 2 and 10 kneeled on the mat, his hands and feet bound, and his eyes wide with terror. A huge hooded man with a broad-bladed sword stood over him. Abdullah stopped walking, transfixed with horror.
Name of God! What could a child that age have possibly done to deserve such a fate?
As if in answer, a high-pitched voice assaulted his ears. Turning toward the sound, he saw a liveried crier standing in an alcove carved in the stone archway above the gate. The man shouted shrilly through a metal cone.
"O fortunate subjects of God's regent in the world, the defender of virtue, the most exalted of men! His Majesty the Caliph, how God smiles upon you to provide you with such a ruler! See how your benevolent monarch, Jabariyak Karari, Caliph of Abaisin and all the Crescent Moon kingdoms, protects you from the grasping hands of thieves! See how he punishes the wicked swiftly and terribly!"
Traffic still moved at an inchworm's pace, but most of the folk on the road were now gawking at the square. Abdullah stood still, wanting to stop this wickedness, but knowing he could not. Someone behind him pushed past, trying to get forward in the press. He looked back to the leather mat.
"Almighty God, why do you allow this? Why do you send me to fight monsters outside of my city while such monsters live within it?"
God did not answer. Rasid, who had also stopped, looked at him with concern.
"Doctor, what do you—"
Without warning, something flew at the hooded executioner's face, covering it in an amber goop. Then the man's chest exploded in red. A crossbow bolt. Men and women screamed. There was a sound like a thunder crack, and a puff of orange smoke suddenly obscured the square. A moment later, the smoke cleared, and Abdullah saw only the sprawled form of the dead executioner. The bound boy was gone. What could... There was another thunder crack, this one from the alcove above the gate. More orange smoke wreathed the recess where the crier had stood. It cleared almost instantly, and Abdullah made out the crier's liveried form slumped at the feet of a tall, broad-shouldered man. This man wore a costume of calfskin and black silk, emblazoned with falcons. His arms were as thick as some men's legs, but he moved like a dancer as he stepped to the alcove's lip.
"It's him," thought Abdullah,
who'd heard much of the man, but never seen him.
"Farad is him is. The
Falcon Prince!"
The words left a dozen mouths around Abdullah.
More trouble.
A confident grin split the famous thief's mustachioed face. Abdullah shouldn't have been able to read the man's facial expression quite so clearly at such a distance. An address spell was at work then, the kind that supposedly only the Khalif could afford. Every person in the crowd would have the same clear view of the Falcon Prince, would hear his words as if he stood beside them, and would find themselves not coerced by the prince's magic, but open to hearing what he had to say. It was likely the only reason they weren't panicking and fleeing. Rashid growled,
"The criminal!"
Well, most people would be open to hearing the man, Abdullah corrected himself. Technically, Abdullah could not dispute Rashid's epithet. 10 years ago, a string of flamboyant robberies of the city's wealthiest citizens were showily announced to be the work of a single brilliant bandit, who called himself the Falcon Prince. Farad Ezhemez, as he had later revealed his name to be. Never himself claimed to be true royalty, but the rumors persisted that he was the last heir of a kingly line from Abbasin's dim past. Royalty or not, the Falcon Prince was one of the most powerful men in Dom Sawat. He and his small army of beggars and thieves had become an almost governmental force, the semi-official voice of the poor. And while the landowners and merchants who took up the cry of share the wealth were few and far between, Abdullah had heard from sound sources that a few of the Caliph's most powerful ministers, due to personal conviction or bribery, secretly backed the bandit.
"God's peace, good people of Dom Sawat!"
the thief boomed, his outstretched arms embracing the crowd.
"Our time together is short. Hear the words of a prince who loves you."
A small, cautious cheer went up from a few corners.
"I've freed an innocent boy from the Caliph's herdsman. His crime? Being fool enough to think he could pick coins from a watchman's purse and feed his ailing mother. Now we grown folk know that watchmen are as attached to their purses as normal men are to their olive sacks."
The bandit grabbed at his crotch, and the crowd laughed hesitantly at his bawdiness.
"But did the child deserve to die? Do we Dom Sawatis care more for the ill-earned wealth of bullies than for the life of a child?"
The crowd grew bolder, and shouts of
"No, no!" and "May God forbid it!"
erupted from all corners. The Falcon Prince stood, hands on hips, drinking it in.
"I am guilty, good people. I freed the boy. I hit the headsman with a honey pie before I killed him. Only a hungry, hungry man would chop off a child's head for a few filthy coins. So I fed him. Honey and steel, good people!"
The crowd laughed loudly now at the Falcon's cheerful, casual tone, and he went on.
"The old Caliph and I were enemies. He was no hero, but he spent 50 years watching over this city, which he loved. But for 3 years now, his fool of a son has bled Dom Sawat. He has tried to find me and kill me. He has failed!"
With the help of the address spell, the Falcon boomed each word with a great drum's rumble. The crowd sent up a boisterous cheer, and a small knot of men took up a chant.
"Fly, fly, O Falcon, thy wing no dart can pierce! Fly, fly, O Falcon, thy heart and eye so fierce!"
The old Isand song, in which a noble falcon gouges out the eyes of a cruel king, had become associated with the Falcon Prince, and the new Khalif had made the singing of it punishable by flogging.
"There's going to be real trouble here."
A dozen watchmen in riveted jerkins shoved their way through the packed crowd toward the gate. They brandished slender steel maces and tried to keep their eyes on the alcove and the crowd at the same time. As the Caliph's men moved toward the knot of singers, the song died down. At once, though, a fresh round of "Fly, O Falcon" went up on the opposite side of the crowd. The watchmen's heads all whipped toward the sound in unison, but they let the singers be and tried to reach the prince himself, who had stopped speechifying to caper to the tune as best he could in the small alcove. The bandit's jollity only caused the singers in the crowd to sing more boisterously. This time, men did not stop chanting when the knot of watchmen passed, and Abdullah saw the Caliph's men were scanning the crowd more anxiously as they made their way toward the gate. A dozen against hundreds. Beside him, Abdullah sensed a sudden battle tension in his protege. Rashid drew his sword soundlessly, and everyone around him took a step back. The blade was two-pronged, according to the traditions of the Order, in order to cleave right from wrong. Adula feared that Rasid was about to try to do so now.
What are you doing?
Adula whispered.
I'm going to help the Watchman, Doctor.
The Falcon Prince is not our enemy, boy.
With apologies, Doctor, he is not a prince. He uses magic to commit crimes. Exactly the sort of thing that we are obligated to fight.
Rasid started to move again, but Adula grabbed his slender shoulder. He could hardly restrain Rasid if the dervish chose to interfere, but Adula hoped his age and authority would prevail.
We are obligated to fight the servants of the traitorous angel. Farad Ezhemez may be a criminal, but he feeds the poor and chastens the proud. Surely even your zealous eyes can see the virtue in that.
The boy said nothing. He frowned hard at Adula. Then he sheathed his sword. In the alcove, the Falcon Prince spread his huge hands wide as if welcoming the approaching watchman to a banquet.
The Caliph's dogs come for me, my friends. If you hear their yappy mouths a-cursing, it is because some scoundrel has sabotaged their crossbows. But this is only the beginning, dear Dom Sawatis. Stand ready! The day comes soon when we take back what is ours. There will be choices before us all, though some would have us believe that they are meant by God to do our choosing for us. But are we, of Dom Sawat, bound by chains forged by the tyrants of past days? Does a man rule us without limit or wisdom just because his father ruled?
A booming, "No!" went up from the crowd, and a dozen different voices shouted support.
Let the Falcon rule! God grant us a wise caliph! No chains here, O Falcon!
Adula would wager money that the flamboyant thief had placed these men and women in the crowd himself. The watchmen were nearly at the gate now, but they had to push through an increasingly hostile crowd. The prince continued.
We of the Jewel of Abyssin love a caliph who does his duty, who helps feed his people, who steals not their coin. But a caliph who dooms us with his greed and his cruelty? Well...
Menace edged into the bandit's voice.
Well, even a caliph is but a man, and better a bad man should die than our good city.
Due to the address spell, everyone in the crowd saw the infectious gleam in the Falcon Prince's eye. A clamor went up from the crowd. Some of it was outraged muttering, but a good number of folk were clearly emboldened by the prince's regicidal words, and they made a lot of noise. At the edge of the crowd, Adula noticed an extravagantly dressed merchant and a liveried civil servant making their way out of the crowd, frightened looks on their faces. Rasid put a hand back to his sword hilt and shifted restlessly.
When there is little food to buy and less work to be had, when half our sons have known the jail and half our daughters have been shamed by watchmen,